From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's get more reaction to Donald Trump's speech last night on immigration, which he gave just hours after meeting with the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, in Mexico City. At that meeting, Trump was serious and conciliatory. Back in Phoenix, he reiterated his plan to build a wall along the border and make Mexico pay for it, and to deport millions of immigrants in this country illegally, starting with those who have committed crimes.
Day one, my first hour in office, those people are gone. And you can call it deported if you want. The press doesn't like that term. You can call it whatever the hell you want. They're gone.
Enrique Acevedo is an anchor and correspondent at Univision. He joins us from the airport in Miami. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. And what was your reaction to Trump's speech last night in Phoenix?
Well, I wasn't surprised, Jeremy. I think to change narrative, you need more than words. You need reality. And up to this point, all we have had from Trump and from his campaign were words about softening, about a major shift on his immigration stance. But what we saw last night is reality. Massive deportations, a deportation force created for that purpose, the wall, the border wall, beautiful border wall, and all the other proposals that he's been saying and presenting since day one.
Well, and do you think after a couple of weeks of talking about softening his stance on immigration that he's changed any minds among Hispanics in the U.S.?
I really don't think so, Jeremy, especially not after last night. The speech was widely distributed in Spanish language media, not only through Univision, but other outlets. So I really don't think that anyone's changed their mind over the softening or so-called softening of his position during the last 2 weeks. Last night confirmed that Trump is not softening his stance on immigration. He's doubling down on his inhumane proposals. And just, I think last night was just louder and validated by the meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto.
Well, let's talk about that, because there were the images earlier in the day of the more diplomatic Trump. Some people were calling him presidential because he was standing at a podium there with President Peña Nieto in Mexico. What did Latinos and Mexican Americans like you make of that?
There was a huge backlash for President Peña Nieto and his government after an invitation and a meeting that left the vast majority of Mexicans and Latinos here in the U.S. feeling betrayed and even humiliated, Jeremy. He's a young politician, Peña Nieto, brought up in the old ways of Mexican politics. I think he thought he could charm and tame Trump. He just should have watched the tape of the primaries before reaching that conclusion. Trump quickly took control of the scene, and when Peña Nieto reacted on Twitter, I think it was already too late.
And what about this disagreement about whether Trump actually told Peña Nieto that he wanted him to pay for the wall? Because we're getting two different stories out of both of those guys.
Of course, and that might have been the case. He might have said or tried to make it clear to Trump that Mexico was not going to pay for that wall. But when he had the opportunity to say that in front of the media to challenge Trump or correct him in public, he just decided not to. I think he was soft or even shy in his reaction. Hmm.
Did that surprise you?
Not really. Peña Nieto is not a confrontational leader, and I think he lacks the tools to, you know, the personality to react to a moment of that stature. I think he lacks the personality, the character to confront Trump, and that's why many Mexicans right from the beginning thought it was a bad idea to have this meeting, and especially a bad idea to have them both standing in front of media and publicly make those statements.
Enrique Acevedo, what did you think of the moment in the speech last night when Trump brought up a number of parents of people who had been killed by undocumented immigrants in this country? This is something that Trump has talked about in the past. It's obviously emotional to see these people talk about that. But what do you think the reaction was from Hispanics in America?
Well, solidarity, of course. I don't think you'll find anyone on either side of the aisle that thinks it's a good idea to free criminals and have them on the street. I just don't think that represents the overwhelming majority of immigrants in this country. I think there are some that have committed crimes and so should be not only arrested, but they should face justice. And eventually be deported from this country back to where they came from. And I think the vast majority of immigrants are law-abiding citizens that reject such behavior and such actions. So when those families stood up with Trump last night and told their stories, I think most Hispanics, at least I can speak for myself, felt solidarity with those families.
So we've been talking about Trump and Hispanics. How's Hillary Clinton doing in reaching out to Hispanics?
Well, she's, I think, had trouble just reaching out, period, because of her lack of contact with the press, her lack of exposure to not only the press, but the public. Their strategy, obviously, is to let Trump talk and let Trump talk himself out of the election and out of the White House. I understand that, but she has to do a better job of reaching out to voters, reaching out to Hispanics, especially to not only tweet or send emails about the different positions on stuff like immigration and issues that are important to Latinos, the economy, jobs, health, education, but to actually go to the communities and stand next to them and explain to them what her plan is, what a Hillary Clinton government would look like for them.
That's Enrique Acevedo, who's an anchor and correspondent at Univision. Enrique, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Well, at Grand Canyon National Park, officials are trying to move past a scathing sexual misconduct report released earlier this year by the U.S. Office of Inspector General. In attempts to change the culture of harassment, the National Park Service is investigating just how extensive complaints of sexual harassment have been at national parks. They're also setting up a confidential hotline for agency employees to report misconduct and, for the first time, have appointed a woman to oversee Grand Canyon operations. Laurel Morales of Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports from Flagstaff.
On a recent summer day, U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and three of the highest-level Park Service officials in the country step out of a black SUV at the rim of the Grand Canyon. They take in the iconic view for a few seconds before turning around to face a group of reporters who want to talk about the ugly events that took place on the river miles below. According to the Office of Inspector General, for about 15 years, male River District employees demanded sex from female coworkers and punished those who refused.
That's unacceptable behavior. It is a failure of leadership. It's something that we have got to address.
Jewell called the victim's stories horrific. One of the 13 employees who sent Jewell a letter that led to the investigation was a river ranger at the park for 5 years. Her name is being withheld for privacy reasons. She and another government employee were working on the river in 2011 when he steered their boat away from the rest of the group.
He exposed his genitalia to me and propositioned me for sex. There were three supervisors on that trip. And I went and told, a supervisor what happened, and he didn't do anything.
In a phone interview, she says she didn't make a formal complaint at the time, fearing retaliation. The Inspector General's report confirms that when women refused advances or complained, they were shamed, denied food on trips, or simply ignored.
It's appalling. I mean, there needs to be some sort of larger reform about how, the system could repeatedly fail over and over again.
According to the Inspector General's office, higher-level officials allowed the hostile culture to fester. In the wake of the report, former Grand Canyon National Park Superintendent Dave Ubaraga chose to retire after the agency offered him a job in Washington. Some say others still working at the park should be fired. But National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis said in a House committee hearing on the issue, it's nearly impossible to fire a government employee because of the many rules and documentation required in the discipline process. So for now, Secretary Jewell wants to focus on what they can do, like hiring a new superintendent.
Frankly, it's going to press a reset button on Grand Canyon National Park, where this is going to be one of the best places to work in the future.
That new superintendent is Christine Lennertz.
Grand Canyon is a place that will lead the National Park Service through making sure our organization and this park are inclusive, respectful, and embrace diversity.
Lennertz is the first woman the park has had in this role. Regional Director Sue Massica hired her.
Chris is known as a collaborator. She's known as very caring and attentive to people. I needed a leader who would come in and set the tone in terms of moving forward, healing this park.
In her email to employees, Leonard says her highest priority is and will always be employee safety. She says it's about setting expectations.
We will not tolerate things like sexism, sexual harassment, sexual assault, racism, all of those things. And the leader has to be very clear at the outset. So there's just no question in anyone's mind that there are rewards for those behaviors that are positive and consequences for those that are negative.
The Grand Canyon isn't the only national park dealing with sexual misconduct. The Office of Inspector General is also investigating claims of sexual harassment at Canaveral National Seashore in Florida. For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
For many people across the country, today is move-in day, September 1st, which could mean plopping down first and last month's rent and a security deposit, maybe a broker fee as well. We wanted to check in on the rental market now in two cities, starting with Cleveland. Chuck Schulman is president of Carlisle Management, which owns or manages 147 properties in Northeast Ohio. And Chuck, how has the apartment market changed in Cleveland in recent years?
It's changed dramatically with the idea that Greater Cleveland 35, 40 years ago started to have a huge exodus of businesses. So there was a lot of empty space downtown where there were major businesses had just moved out of Cleveland, gone to other cities. There were very few apartments actually downtown, approximately 4,000. And then now all of a sudden there are 21,000 units with almost 8,000 units still to be built or in the process of being converted and repurposing existing office buildings to really attract people back into downtown Cleveland.
Is it a renter's market or a landlord's market?
Actually, it's pretty much still a landlord's market. Renters are getting some decent deals, but all of a sudden there's a tremendous demand. So as a result, the landlords are really able to call their own shots for the first time.
What's the average rent right now for a one-bedroom in Cleveland?
Well, it's really all over the board. You can, in certain neighborhoods, get a one-bedroom apartment still in the $600 range, and in other neighborhoods, you'd be well over $1,250, just depending on which area you're looking at. And there's a lot of regentrification going on. So some of the areas that historically were on the lower end are all of a sudden turning into very strong markets with much higher rents.
Now, Northeast Ohio was one of the areas that was worst hit by the foreclosure crisis. Today, Akron and Cleveland still have among the highest proportion of underwater houses on the market. Is that affecting the rental market?
That is dramatically, as well as the way the 2008-2009 debacle happened, it affected the condominium market, which was very strong here in a huge way. And that is really the hardest hit portion of the market still. You're still seeing a lot of empty units, foreclosures still pending from back then. And a lot of people are still underwater or just truly upside down on their condominium units. That's driving people back into apartments.
And certainly in many areas of the country, if in the heart of the financial crisis, you had decided to buy rather than rent, you would be in much better shape today. Is that the case in Cleveland? And how often do you advise people to forget about renting and just try to buy instead?
Well, very often we do that. It just depends on their circumstance. There are many times where buying is definitely a better option. Right now, though, what we're seeing is a lot of people who are looking for the rich amenities renting apartments now, and many of the new buildings or the repurposed buildings are very high amenity buildings. You're not going to be able to do something like that if you're buying a starter home or if you're buying a mid-range home. So if you're not looking for the high amenity package, buying right now is a tremendous bargain.
That's Chuck Schulman, who is president of Carlisle Management, which owns or manages 147 properties in Northeast Ohio in the Cleveland area. Chuck, thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, meanwhile, Houston is dealing with a glut of housing after years of growth. Tim Surratt is a realtor with Greenwood King Properties in Houston and a board member of the Houston Association of Realtors. Tim, what's driving all that construction in Houston?
It's a combination of things. For one thing, for over 5 years, we've had less than 4 months of inventory of housing. So if you put your house on the market and sell it, we can't find a place quick enough for you to get into. So there's a lot of transitional people in between houses when we sell their house and they need to still look and don't want to look under pressure. So we have that. And then we've added, in the last 10 years, we've added over 1 million people to Houston. And our housing stock, frankly, has not kept up with it.
So what does that mean for people who are renting? What kind of money do they have to pay to get an apartment?
I think the average single-family home is about $1,800 a month, and the multifamily is $1,630 per month.
And is that going up?
It has. It's, the price of the townhomes is up 10%.
Are you seeing people who have been renting being forced out, being forced to go get an apartment further outside of the city because the prices are going up?
We are. That's happening, and they're also moving from Class A construction to Class B or C. That means instead of these brand-new apartments with granite countertops and dishwashers and air conditioning and fancy pools, they're having to downstep a little bit if they want to stay in the neighborhoods they want.
Are you seeing a change in the types of people who are renting versus buying in Houston?
Yes, I think so. We're seeing a lot of empty nesters moving in from the suburbs to see if they really like living in the city that are leasing, and it's been a lot of fun to deal with them. They're very happy to come into the city. They're so excited. They call me when their kids are in their senior year, usually around January or February, and they can't get inside the what we call the loop fast enough, which is close to our downtown center.
Are you worried with all of the construction of new places to keep up with this demand that you're going to end up with a glut of housing on the market when there's a change in people's behavior or when there's a downturn in the economy?
We're not worried because, frankly, we've been 2 years into the depressed oil prices and we've survived it, much to our shock. We're very pleased that our economy was diversified enough to survive it.
How is all of this construction changing the character of the city?
Before, Houston had two-story apartment complexes and not very many residential high-rises. And in the last 5 years, there's over 40 high-rises that have been built for residential living. I'm talking 10 stories to 30 stories. In addition to that, they've done what's called eight-story wraps, which is looks very similar to Washington, D.C. So if you're around DuPont Circle and places like that.
So it's starting to feel a little more East Coast.
It feels the density has gone up significantly. I'd be curious to find out how significantly, but you can definitely feel it.
If someone asks you whether they should rent or buy in Houston right now, what would you tell them?
It depends upon how long they're going to be here. If they're going to be here 1 or 2 years, which we have a lot of people sliding through town on corporate relocations, it'll be here for 2 years. It's tough to buy and recoup your money no matter what environment you're in. But if you're going to be here 3 to 5 years, you're going to lose money by renting versus buying, in my opinion.
That's Tim Surratt, who's a realtor with Greenwood King Properties in Houston. He's also on the board of the Houston Association of Realtors. Thanks so much, Tim.
It's been my pleasure.
And finally, let's talk about the national picture with Svenja Gedell, chief economist at Zillow, the online real estate database. She joins us via Skype from Seattle. Svenja, what are you seeing when you look at rental markets in cities around the country?
In general, we've been seeing solid growth on the rental side. Currently, rents are growing at 2.2% annually. Our forecast is for that to stay roughly the same, right around 2% over the next year. However, some markets are appreciating it faster than other markets. And the markets that are seeing the most appreciation are located in the Pacific Northwest and in California, where you have Seattle growing at 10% annually, for example, and places like Portland and Denver not far behind.
And nationally, we know that home ownership is at a 50-year low, while the share of U.S. households that rent is nearing a 50-year high. What is driving the shift to renting?
You know, it's really a couple of things going on there. And most of the household formation that we're seeing currently is actually on the rental side. And one of the things that we're seeing is that homeowners currently are older than they've ever been. People are having a hard time saving for a down payment, oftentimes because their rental rates are relatively high and it's, you know, putting a dent in their piggy bank, if you will. Then also we're seeing that some folks are still having a hard time accessing or qualifying for a mortgage. And lastly, I think the biggest driver that we're seeing that is impeding buying homeownership right now is being able to find an affordable home that you can buy. And oftentimes people have to search for several months or even years in order to find a home. And they're facing tough competition in the market with multiple bids coming in on homes and oftentimes having to go through this process numerous times before they actually are able to buy a home.
And if they're not able to buy a home and they have to rent, it sounds like their rent is going up. Their rent has been going up. Are they getting kind of a bad deal because of the market?
They certainly are, yes. And, you know, it's the kind of situation where these cities that are actually doing quite well in terms of economy and job growth, such as, you know, San Francisco, Denver's, Austin, Seattle, are seeing a bunch of people moving to the area, attracting new talent. And as we are seeing more people come to the market, they're demanding more housing. And so prices are being driven up both on the for sale and the, on the for rent side. And oftentimes people are forced to pay a good chunk of their income towards either one of these. And so less money is actually left over at the end of the day for savings. And it is a tough situation to be in because you're either dealing with having to increase your rents or having to absorb that rental shock every single year as you're renewing your lease, or having to face an extremely tough market on the for sale side.
So what's the impact of so many people renting instead of buying on the economy? Because homeownership has been a major engine of the U.S. economy for a long time.
It has been, but I'm probably less worried than some folks out there in terms of what this means to be at a relatively low homeownership rate, right around 63%. Yes, it's lower than we have been, but not that much lower than we were back in the 90s. And I do think that over the next few years, we will start to trend back up again. I don't think we will remain a, you know, for lack of a better word, a nation of renters, as oftentimes it's been referred to. I do think we'll start to see more people getting back into homeownership. And a lot of this is demographically driven.
That's Svenja Gedell, who's chief economist at Zillow. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And we'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org. If you are renting, are you seeing your rent go up this year? Are you thinking about buying? Have you looked at that calculation? And what have you decided?
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
American importers are trying to figure out what to do after one of the world's largest container carriers, South Korea's Hanjin, filed for bankruptcy yesterday. The move is already creating headaches at ports from L.A. to New York, and it comes at a particularly bad time as retailers are importing goods for the holiday season. Business journalist Ali Velshi joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy. Good to talk to you again.
Good to have you. And Hanjin is the world's seventh largest shipper by capacity. I'm sure people have seen these shipping containers. If they've ever seen any place that has shipping containers, it has more than $5 billion in debt. But what's going on with this bankruptcy?
Well, there are two things. Part of it is Hanjin. It's the biggest shipper in South Korea. It was being supported by the Korea Development Bank. That was the main creditor. They pulled their support on Tuesday. Hanjin's been struggling for a while. It's posted a loss every year for the last 5 years. Now, the problem is they are one of the world's biggest carriers. They're the seventh largest shipping line by capacity, and there is a global glut of shipping, of ships. So there's too much capacity available. Rates are going down, so the globe's shipping is suffering, and Hanjin is the first one in probably about 30 years to declare bankruptcy.
And what does this mean for the Hanjin ships that are already out there?
Well, it moves mostly manufactured products and consumer goods. So it's electronics, clothing, furniture, toys, goes to U.S. retailers, including Amazon. So if you're a buyer, you're planning to be a buyer around Christmas time of a Samsung product or an LG product, you want to think about this. It accounts for 3.1% of global container capacity. Hanjin has now stopped accepting any cargo from the Koreans or from anyone else that was meant to be delivered in the United States. A number of these Hanjin vessels that have arrived in port have been unable to dock. The docks won't take them in because they're thinking they may not get paid. Ports in China, Spain, the U.S. have blocked access to these ships. So the goods are sitting offshore in ships. In a number of places, including China and Singapore, Hanjin ships have been seized. Someone has got a court order to seize the ships because of money they're owed. So it's a mess.
And what happens to the goods if the ship gets turned away?
Well, they will sit there in port. People who are importing goods now have some choices to make. They've either got to find another shipper to bring a new order of goods. And the problem with that, Jeremy, is that even though there's an excess of shipping capacity in the world, this particular action has caused rates to increase dramatically. So a rate to ship one container of goods from South Korea to the United States East Coast has now gone up by 50%. It's about $2,400 a container. Mm.
And does that get passed on to the consumer? Are we going to see higher prices on all the things that we buy this holiday season because of this?
Well, the market doesn't tend to accept those higher prices, particularly when it comes to electronic goods. So what it really means likely is delays. It means that if you were planning on buying that new LG OLED TV, you may want to think about that now as opposed to later. Where it's really going to affect people is these so-called fast fashion retailers, places that move very seasonally. They've got clothes stuck on these ships that are going to be in the wrong season.
Well, and at the rate we're going right now, based on the prices that I have seen, those fancy televisions are going to be selling for about $5 in a couple of months because they're dropping so quickly.
They are dropping, but this may cause a short-term spike.
Mm. Business journalist Ali Velshi, thank you so much as always.
My pleasure.
Stem cells can be harvested to grow into mature cells. There are trials to see if they can treat Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, type 1 diabetes. But there are only a handful of diseases for which the FDA has approved stem cell therapy, most of them blood disorders, leukemias. So why are there almost 600 stem cell clinics in the U.S.? Here's YouTube sound from one in Mississippi, a woman with debilitating MS telling the clinic their stem cell therapy allowed her to walk at an amusement park.
We walked around. I walked around with no cane or anything for 7 hours. Rode the Titan. A child wanted to kill me.
Right.
Is it real? Researchers say probably not, and in a few weeks, the FDA is set to hold hearings. Researcher Paul Knopfler of the University of California blogs about stem cells and recently published a study about these unregulated clinics in the online journal Cell Stem Cell. And Professor, you've spoken to the clinics. What do they say?
Yeah, so I've called the clinics, I've emailed with them, I've actually gone in person to one of their informational seminars. They really think, for the most part, they're okay with the FDA because so far the FDA hasn't told them otherwise. They kind of interpret the lack of hearing from the FDA as kind of this green light to go ahead with this stuff.
Well, they might hear from them in a couple of weeks after that meeting, but first, how do we get there? Because you now write this blog, you got interested in that, maybe 2010, if I'm reading correctly, when there were what, maybe a dozen or so clinics?
Yeah, you know, my guess is there were one or two dozen of these clinics 6 years ago, and now it's just been something that's been mushrooming around 600 of these clinics right here in the U.S. So for the most part, the FDA hasn't really done a lot, which is surprising. They've taken about one or so action against stem cell clinics per year in the last 6 or so years.
Well, and you remind us there used to be stem cell tourism. People would go outside of the U.S. Why are you so concerned? People in advertisements from these clinics swear that the stem cell therapy helped them.
You know, it definitely makes things sound really great. You know, there are these new therapies based on stem cells. They can help you in ways, you know, that traditional medicine can't. But with only very few exceptions, there's really very little science behind that. And, you know, there is a great deal of legitimate excitement about stem cells. My own lab works on stem cells, and there's literally thousands of clinical trials going on with stem cells. But I think what's happened with the clinics is they've taken this big shortcut. And so the traditional thing you're supposed to do with a new kind of medical product is you study it, for instance, in rats or mice, you collect data, you talk with the FDA about setting up clinical trials, and you go through this process to really prove that there's a good chance of this thing working and it being safe. And what the clinics have done is they've just kind of blown off that whole process and taken the unproven stem cells right to consumers and said, you know, hey, if you give us $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, you know, we'll give you these stem cells and, you know, maybe they'll help you. And some clinics were pretty straightforward. They said, you know, they could just treat one thing, you know, like an arthritic knee or something with stem cells. But others were more disturbing. They had a whole menu, perhaps 3 dozen different things that they said they could treat with just one kind of stem cell, like stem cells from fat tissue. And many of the things on the menu really had nothing to do with fat stem cells. And they kind of ran the gamut from Alzheimer's to diabetes to lung disease. And they're pretty sketchy. You know, there's not much to support those claims.
Well, and as you and others have said, you don't know if it's causal. In other words, someone might feel a little bit better after a stem cell treatment, but you don't know. Mm-hmm. But what about people, Professor Knopfler, who don't feel they have the time for FDA testing? Their loved ones have Alzheimer's, and they're willing to try it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear from patients all the time. And one of the things that got me concerned about the stem cell clinics is the number of patients who are reaching out to me has just skyrocketed in the last few years. And so as I email with them and I talk with them, I'm very sensitive to the fact that in many cases, they don't or their loved ones don't have time to wait, you know, 5-10 years. You know, I go through the science with them in sort of a straightforward kind of way. And I explain, you know, as much as, you know, there is an urgency, getting one of these unproven stem cell treatments could really do more harm than good. Side effects like potentially cancer or tumors. We saw a patient a few weeks ago who got a stem cell treatment get a big tumor growing on his spine. And so as much as, you know, there is a very understandable sense of urgency amongst many patients, they need to realize that as much as their current situation could be really bad, that an unproven stem cell treatment could make it even worse.
Well, keep going, because you talk about cancer. Are you saying that the cells might be cancerous?
They can be, yeah, in certain circumstances. If you inject cells, and it depends on the patient. It depends how the cells were manufactured by the stem cell clinic. You know, these living cells can do unpredictable things like grow a tumor. In other cases, we've seen reports of immune reactions. Blood clots in the lungs are a risk. Another risk is that the patients stop taking their current medicine, you know, and they think the stem cells will just do everything by themselves. And the other risk is financial. You know, people don't have, you know, most of us don't have $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 lying around to spend on a stem cell treatment that may not work. And oftentimes patients will turn to their families, their churches, they'll go on online fundraising sites to try to scrape together these large sums of money to give to the clinics. And so, you know, when I've talked to the clinics, I really press them on that. And I say, you know, how can you justify charging so much money for something that you can't really be sure works and is safe? And they don't have a great answer for that.
Well, look, we were astonished when we read Gina Coletta's terrific reporting in the New York Times and as many as 600 clinics across the country. But how could this have happened? I mean, how can it be that the FDA has allowed this to happen? You wouldn't have another kind of clinic injecting something into someone and making claims. That wouldn't go this far. How did this happen?
That's a great question, and that's something we're currently doing research on and trying to figure out. And I think one possibility is, again, if we go back to maybe, you know, 5-6 years ago when there were a couple dozen of these clinics in the U.S. and everyone was thinking about stem cell tourism, you know, maybe that kind of frame of mind, that old data, is what the FDA has been thinking the reality is still today. The other option or other possibility is that they know, you know, this is a potentially big problem. But what we've seen over the years is the FDA budget has been really static over the years. It's probably decreased compared to inflation. And as you know, the FDA has a ton of different responsibilities. And so it may be they know this is a problem, but they just don't have the resources to go after it, you know, adequately. If you think about 600 clinics, you know, not all of them are necessarily running afoul of FDA regulations.
Well, let me jump in there to say that there are some regulations. Stem cells from amniotic fluid do not qualify under the FDA's rules. They're not from the patient's body. So the FDA does have rules about when stem cells can be used. They have to be used from the body. Mm-hmm. And then there are different kinds of qualifying questions that are asked for the treatment of things, as we said, like leukemia. So there is some proper usage.
There are rules. You're absolutely right. And certain kinds of stem cells, they're considered a drug and they have to be pre-approved by the FDA before you market them to patients. And unfortunately, many clinics today are not getting the FDA approval. And right now, it has some new rules that it's considering. It's having a meeting in a couple weeks. New rules called draft guidances and get public comment. And I'm hoping they're going to proceed with those rules, which are going to, I think, make some of these clinics get more squarely on the radar screen of the FDA.
Well, meantime, while we have you, Professor Knopfler, when do you think we will be using stem cells to replace damaged cells and slow down Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, mm-hmm. to maybe even grow a new pancreas for people with type 1 mm-hmm. diabetes? When do you think?
You know, all of those examples you gave, for each of them, there actually are clinical trials ongoing with stem cells that look really promising so far. And And while many of them are kind of in the early days, you know, their early phase clinical trials, you know, so far there's some encouraging data there. And for instance, there's a couple groups that are studying how you could make a new pancreas from stem cells. And one of those companies out here in California has started a clinical trial where they're implanting little mini bioengineered pancreases into patients with diabetes. And right now they're collecting data to see, you know, could that actually help these patients manage their blood sugar? So, you know, I want to be sure to emphasize I'm a stem cell biologist myself. I'm very excited about stem cell potential for helping people. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, as much as there's this super level of excitement and hype, even in some cases, we have to be really careful about how we proceed, and we need to get the data to really show, you know, hey, this treatment works and is safe, but this other one, maybe not so much. Yeah. You know, just shooting out all these therapies, trying them out in patients, collecting millions of dollars. The other thing I do worry about is that the clinics are going to end up hurting the stem cell research field overall, because patients are going to get hurt, and the public's going to associate that with stem cell research, even though most stem cell research is perfectly legitimate. Yeah.
That's Paul Knopfler, professor of cell biology at the University of California, Davis Medical School. Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we'll post his study on unregulated clinics. We'll follow the upcoming FDA hearings. And ahead of that, we want to hear your experiences at stem cell clinics.
M.L. Stedman's best-selling book, The Light Between Oceans, tells the story of a couple that raises a child who doesn't belong to them. Now, it's a film starring Michael Fassbender, written and directed by Derek Cianfrance. Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa spoke with both men and discovered that turning a much-loved book into a film together takes a certain chemistry.
Writer-director Derek Cianfrance's previous films include the critically acclaimed Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines. When he was looking for a new project, DreamWorks studio executives gave him a copy of M.L. Stedman's The Light Between Oceans. He read it and was blown away.
By the end of the book, I was on the C train in New York City and I was in tears. And it's so embarrassing to cry in public. But I thought to myself, if anyone had been reading what I was reading, they too would be in tears. And I went after the adaptation and that, you know, I told them that I was born to make it.
Cianfrance had one actor in mind for the central character Tom Sherborn, Michael Fassbender, the German-Irish actor best known for playing Magneto in the X-Men films, or his Oscar-nominated turn as Apple founder Steve Jobs.
We're leaving the old Apple I.O. behind. Stereo surround sound built into every product, a great keyboard, and the coolest mouse you've ever seen.
Cianfrance was a little uncertain at first about the casting.
I feel like Michael, that I've seen in movies, has always been like a mental giant. I feel like he's an incredibly powerful brain on the screen. And what I hadn't seen from him in a movie was the exploration of his heart. I'm looking for this transmutation when I make a film, the transmutation between the actor and the character. They have to become one.
But after meeting Michael Fassbender, he was convinced that he had made the right choice. The Light Between Oceans is set just after World War I. Tom Sherborn, a veteran of that war, takes a job as a lighthouse keeper on a remote island called Janus. Michael Fassbender says it's a job that Tom is made for.
He had sort of made a pact that if he would get out of the war, he would make sure that he wouldn't harm another person for the rest of his life. And so that was one of the deciding factors to pick a job which had him in total isolation as a lighthouse keeper on the island of Janus, that he couldn't bring any more harm to anybody because he would be in total isolation.
Tom's plans for total isolation are turned upside down when he meets Isabel, played in the film by Alicia Vikander. She's an impulsive young woman, fascinated by Tom and by the island.
Take me out to James with you. What? I want to see it. I want to see where you hide yourself away.
I'm afraid that would be against Commonwealth rules. The only woman allowed on Janus is the keeper's wife.
Then marry me.
Tom and Isabel do marry and build a life together on Janus. But despite its remote beauty, the couple can't avoid heartache. Isabel's desire to have children leads them to take a step that has devastating consequences. Director Derek Cianfrance says the island was so central to his storytelling that he found a remote peninsula in New Zealand to stand in for Janus. He had his actors live there while filming.
I wanted to make a primal piece, a piece about human nature set against Mother Nature. And I felt like living on this peninsula, isolated from cell phones and computers and the news and the rest of the world, I felt like we could go to this very primal human place.
The peninsula had its own lighthouse, and Fassbender took on keeper duties.
All Michael did for the first 3 days was polish the lens every morning, fix hinges on doors, and he would make his bed, and he would make sure the light was clean. And 3 days in, I remember he asked my costume designer, he said, "When are we going to start shooting the movie?" She said that we are. We've been shooting it this whole time.
Living on location gave Michael Fassbender a taste of what lighthouse keepers went through.
We were all living in caravans on site. So at nighttime, a couple of times I thought the caravan was actually going to topple over. The winds were so extreme. And actually getting up the steps to the lighthouse was near impossible without a railing when those storms kicked up. And it made me realize how wind can really sort of send people mad.
And for Derek Cianfrantz, while filming on the peninsula, he saw what he had hoped for, the transmutation of Michael Fassbender.
I went up to him and I asked him just to pray for himself. And it was, you know, he kneeled down and he started to pray and he started to cry, Michael did. You know, he broke. And I remember that was that moment when Tom and Michael became one to me.
And Fassbender brought that vulnerability to the rest of his performance as Tom Sherbourne.
For many years, everything I touched would fade away. And you are so full of life. That scares me.
Talking to Fassbender and his director about the process of making The Light Between Oceans, I asked Fassbender if he ever thinks about moving behind the camera to direct a film of his own.
Yeah, more and more. I would like to try it, for sure.
If he does, Fassbender already has his first fan, Derek Cianfrantz.
He's got incredible instincts on character and incredible instincts on story, and he's the smartest guy in the room in any room he walks into. So if Michael wanted to make a movie, I'd be the first in line to buy a ticket to that.
In the meantime, there's The Light Between Oceans. It opens in theaters tomorrow. For Here and Now, I'm Emiko Tamagawa.